From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jessica Yellen in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Watching Julia Louis-Dreyfus play the Vice President of the United States on the HBO series Veep, you might ask yourself, can it really be this nuts in Washington?
How are you? I see you. I see you.
There's Congresswoman Clements. You should speak with her.
She's got a small mustache. It's a little disturbing. Don't stare at it. Okay?
The show's creator, Armando Iannucci, has had a hugely successful career, both here and in Britain, by getting viewers to ask themselves exactly that question. The wackier his satire gets, the more you worry that maybe our politics really is that bad. This hour on Point, Armando Iannucci on politics and satire. You can join us on air or online. Are you a Veep watcher? Do you think our real-life vice presidents and their staff could possibly be as keystone wacky as Selina Meyer on Veep? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from London is Armando Iannucci. His hit TV shows in Britain include The Thick of It, Knowing Me, Knowing You, and I'm Alan Partridge, starring Steve Coogan. He directed the 2009 movie In the Loop about the invasion of Iraq, and his hilarious series Veep has just started its third season on HBO. It stars Julia Louis-Dreyfus as Vice President Selina Meyer. You can see a trailer for the third season on our website, onpointradio.org. Armando, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jessica. Thank you for having me.
I'm a big watcher of Veep. I love it. I've covered Washington politics for 9 years, and I know a lot of Washingtonians who say Veep is the most accurate portrayal of what politics is really like. I would define it as, I should pause there and say, does that scare you or make you excited?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I'm kind of hugely flattered that all our research has paid off, but also frightened that the secret's out and that it is as frantic as you sometimes see it in those episodes. Yeah.
So I would describe the show as sort of a profane version of The Office set in the White House, where just about every major decision is the result of a series of mistakes. How do you describe the show? What's sort of your elevator pitch for it?
Well, I was a big fan of an early HBO comedy, The Larry Sanders Show, which was a behind-the-scenes comedy set in a late-night chat show.
Gary Shandling,
Gary Shandling was the star, and it was very, very, it felt real. That's the thing. It didn't have the sitcom music. It didn't have caricatures. It had well-rounded characters. And you could tell that the people writing it, the people making it, really knew what they were talking about. You got that sense that that must be what it's really like working on a daily basis behind the scenes in a very popular late-night chat show, talk show. So I always saw that as a great model. And also, I'm fascinated by politics, and I think you always write about what you're interested in. So I feel very positive about politics, but I knew that I wanted to make something set in the political world, but make it funny, but give it that air of reality. So it's sort of, yes, it's sort of the West Wing meets the Larry Sanders Show, I suppose.
At the center of the show is Julia Louis-Dreyfus's character, the vice president. And yeah. I want to play another clip from the show. In this scene from the second season, the vice president's staff discusses her odd attraction to her ex-husband, Andrew. Now, the vice president is planning to celebrate her daughter's birthday. And while she's there, we know she's going to flirt with her ex-husband and simultaneously try to forge a budget deal with the opposing party in Congress.
Every time Andy's on the scene, she gets all
giddy. She's this terrible laugh. She's like...
Yeah, exactly.
With a...
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She just says she hates him.
She does. But every time she gets around him...
It's so weird. It's like a cat on a hot tin dog.
Gary?
Yeah?
You know my red thing?
Yeah?
Do you think that it shows enough skin?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to be the sexiest woman to ever exude fiscal prudence.
I mean, Julia Louis-Dreyfus's character, she's ambitious, politically flexible, a strategic infighter, but constantly gets it wrong. All those descriptions would make a Washington politician unpopular, but she is simultaneously awful and likable. How do you achieve that?
Well, I mean, that's an important point, because I to those who maybe say that this portrays a sort of cynical view of politics in Washington, I always say, no, actually, the person you feel more sympathy for is the elected politician. You kind of feel sorry for her in that she has principles and she has opinions and she has views. But within the system that she works in, these are steadily compromised. She's forced to go down opinions that she doesn't really believe in. She is forced to backtrack. She has a 24-hour media that are constantly tweeting about her and taking photographs of her and commenting on her. So there's 101 fires to put out every hour. And I think that's what we tried to get right in Veep. We wanted it to be funny and yet believable. The kind of mistakes that the people make there are, I think, are mistakes that you and I would make if you were under that sort of pressure. So it's not really, I mean, you talked about Keystone, but it's not really showing Washington to be full of idiots. It's more Washington full of political animals who have somehow become a little bit battered and jaded by the kind of system they have to work in.
And it's the rest of those Washingtonians, it's her staff office that makes the show work so well. We heard them in that clip there, but there's Amy, her chief of staff, who is constantly being undermined and so busy fighting off the people who are undermining her, she sometimes can't do her job. Dan,
yes, she's the tensest woman in America, Amy.
Is she based on someone in particular?
No, none of these people are based on any one individual. They're more, I spend a lot of time coming out to DC and talking to people and asking them all the dull stuff, actually. I said, look, I'm not out to do expose scandals and bring Washington to its knees. I actually want to know the boring stuff. What time do you get in the morning? What time do you go home? What are the people like that you have to work with? What are the offices like? And gradually a picture builds up of what DC is like and the types of people that someone like the vice president would have around them. Now, if we wanted to be absolutely perfectly accurate, we would have a staff of 100 people underneath her. But you can't really do a 30-minute weekly sitcom featuring 100 characters every week have come up with storylines that are mostly about her sitting behind her desk, reading things and writing things. You know, so you've got to simplify it a bit, and so we've simplified it into these five or six key types. So there's Amy, this sort of tense chief of staff. There's Dan Egan, who's the sort of young, much more ambitious aide, who's clearly mapped out his career on the back of an envelope, and has got a 15-year plan for when he becomes president. And there's people like Jonah Ryan, who really works in the White House for the president, but has such a lowly job that the only thing that I think makes him survive each day is the fact that he can tell people outside that he works for the president.
And come to the vice president's office and name drop that he's been over in the West Wing. And
yes,
it shows up how there's that tension between the vice president's office and the president's office. And Jonah, I imagine, he's this sort of know-it-all junior staffer who's constantly bossing people around and trying to make them feel left out, even though he's not that important himself.
Well, there is that thing. There's lots in the White House. There are lots of 24, 25-year-olds who feel they are far more powerful than any of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you know, and behave that way.
And, you know, covering Washington, I've seen these types, and I imagine Jonah is the character Washingtonians say they like best. But I feel like he's a guy everybody knows from their office in their own context.
Absolutely, yes. No one will say that they're Jonah, but everyone will say they know our Jonah. It's wrong to identify yourself with Jonah. But he, I remember one guy we were talking to when we were researching the show said when he briefly worked in the White House, he knew when he was ringing out and someone else, say he was ringing some department or maybe ringing another state or a relative of someone, and they picked up the phone and he would say, hello, it's the White House here. He said he knew, he could just tell that on the other end of the phone, they were holding the phone up to everyone in the room and mouthing, it's the White House. He could hear that excitement come down the line. And he said that kept him going through the day, just that knowing that you could do that to people whenever you rung them. And he kind of missed it after the other thing is they burn out after about 18 months.
Right.
They all have to get out because the hours are terrible. The workspace is atrocious. We were given this tour of the West Wing and it looks grand on the outside, but inside it's a whole warren of small rooms packed with too many people because everyone wants to say they work in the West Wing. So they'd rather be given a tiny, tiny desk space than be moved to a building a little bit further away. I was shocked to see the room right outside the Oval Office where the likes of George Stephanopoulos resided when he was Bill Clinton's communications director.
I know, whenever I've given... It's tiny.
Yeah, it's smaller than a closet. It's extraordinary.
Whenever
but
I've
it's all to do with space, yeah.
Tours of the White House, people are constantly saying, this is so much smaller than I expected. And and they believe it's not as glamorous inside as people like to imagine. I think Julia Louis-Dreyfus is best known for playing Elaine in Seinfeld. Here in the U.S. she is, and she's perfect for the role. She's, you know, always bored or irritated by the public, contemptuous of the people she works with, impatient with her life. But she's determined to charge ahead. How much of that is what Julia Louis-Dreyfus brings to the role, or do you write her that way?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I wouldn't say that Julia herself is bored and impatient with the people she works with. She's the opposite in that she's very much, she enjoys being sort of team leader, you know, galvanizing everyone, getting the enthusiasm going in the room. But what she does bring is a fact that she grew up in Washington, so she knows these people. But also, she's been on a large public stage for the last 20 years.
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. My guest is Armando Iannucci, writer and director of HBO's Veep and a whole slew of lacerating send-ups of our politician. Armando, thanks again for being with us. And I want to get to my favorite character in the show, Gary. He is the vice president's personal assistant. And I think Washington is filled with these people who are unbelievably competent, attracted to powerful people, but treated as if they are invisible themselves. I'd like to play a little bit of Gary's interaction with the chief of staff for the vice president that was in the series pilot of the comet of Veep. Just to set it up, Julia Louis-Dreyfus is navigating a crowd at a DC fundraiser, and her aides are preparing for her speech. You'll hear Amy, the chief of staff, guiding her through the crowd, pointing out politicians the Veep should know, and then Gary, her personal aide, telling her the details about each of the people she'll see. Note, the vice president is tiny and has to stand on a box to get over the podium.
There's Congresswoman Clements. You should speak with her.
She's got a small mustache. It's a little disturbing. Don't stare at it.
Okay? Mm-hmm. Podium is definitely too high.
Box me, Gary. Box me.
Oh, yeah.
What is the utensil situation? Is it cornstarch or plastic here?
Stay away from both. The utensils are politicized.
I love that the staff has endless amounts of detail, helps her through everything, and yet they get almost no recognition for it. Do you think that is a specific kind of dynamic that happens around politics, or is it universal?
Oh, I think there's something about politics because a lot of Gary's official role is called the body man, which makes him sound rather hefty and powerful. But basically, he's the bag man. He's the guy who carries the vice president's bag around, but also, you know, copies of her speech, bits of information about every person that she's meeting that he can whisper in her ear. And it's a vital role. And if you speak to any bagman in D.C., they'll say, yes, you are a little bit like a servant, like a butler in a way. But on the other hand, how exciting is it to be so close to power, to be in the room with the vice president or the president, to meet these heads of state? I think they put up with the being treated like a fifth-class citizen for the benefit of being right at the heart of the action. Now, what Gary is, though, is a bagman who stayed on a little bit too long. I think the best of them stop after a couple of years and get out when they're about 22, 23, maybe a little bit older. But Gary's now in his early 40s, so he does look like a middle-aged man carrying someone else's purse. And I think there is that attraction to power, the fact that we were saying earlier, the fact that people will put up with living in tiny little closets if it means they're right next to the Oval Office, the indignities that they'll put up with in order to be so close to being in the room. In the room is the phrase that they always use.
Right.
You know, you want to be in the room. In fact, somebody told me that, you know, the problem is if you leave the room, you leave power. So apparently there was a Secretary of State who taught her staff what she called bladder diplomacy, which was basically how to be in meetings for up to 6 hours without having to leave to go to the restroom. Because if you left, you know, a decision might be made that you weren't part of.
Right. They say that one has a bladder of steel, is the saying.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, yes. Madeleine Albright was the one who taught bladder diplomacy.
I love it. You know, that is what you get so well in the show, is that you focus on the little things and you get the absurdities of office politics so right. Anybody listening knows you're not from the U.S. So do you just do a whole lot of research for every episode?
Absolutely. And as I was saying, you know, the more you talk to people, the more people you meet. And by the way, in DC, they're very welcoming. There wasn't that sense of why should we speak to you? You're out to paint a negative picture of us. Everyone was very welcoming. We were allowed into the vice president's offices. We were allowed to take photos of the drapes and measure up, and so that we could recreate it absolutely perfectly. Everyone was very, very forthcoming, because I did say, we're not doing an impersonation of anyone. We're not out to reveal any scandals. We just want to show how it really is. And I think for a lot of them, there's that sense of relief that this portrayal of this nonstop, rather exhausting and frantic round-the-clock activity that they undertake is actually being portrayed. Because that's what a lot of the comedy is about. It's about not people being bad at their job, but being people having an impossible job, and therefore you're going to start fraying at the edges, and people are going to start noticing when you start making mistakes. It's all about, in many ways, it's all about the pressure we put on our politicians, and that's a universal thing. It's not just in America. I think it's across the globe. We expect our politicians to be perfect. We expect them not to go on holiday. We expect them to have a perfect answer for any problem. And we expect them to work around the clock. And on top of that, there is this 24-hour media cycle, which means that, you know, we're all reporters now because we have our phones that can take photographs and we can record. There are 6 billion reporters out there who can record any mistake that anyone ever makes.
That's actually a storyline in the current season.
Yeah.
And in DC, you have somebody who is anonymously blogging from the West Wing and creating trouble. Yeah. And in DC, just a few months ago, there was an anonymous tweeter sending scathing emails about the administration. It had busy government officials scrambling to figure out who it is, and it turned out it was someone in the West Wing. So I'm curious, did you imitate that, or did you get it lucky?
I'll tell you that we shot that show before that happened. we shot that, and we have various DC consultants who look at every script that we do and just advise us on the accuracy. And quite a few of them, when we first came up with that storyline, quite a few of them came back and said, there's no way that would happen. If anyone did that and they were in the White House, they would be thrown out instantly.
He was.
And then that story happened the next day. And so the consultants came back to us and said, okay, keep it in. Keep it in. It's fine.
It was dead on. It's pretty fun.
Yeah.
I'm curious, what do people inside the White House tell you about the show? Do they love it? Are they critical?
I think they're very, you know, polite. And again, they're very keen to identify themselves with the characters. So I know Julia had dinner with the vice president,
right,
or lunch with the vice president. But she said it was very funny because the vice president's staff came up to her and said, hi, I'm the Amy of the office, and this is our Sue, and I'm the Dan. And so there is that. I think there's always that sense of recognition. And also, you know, I'm kind of hoping they get so used to seeing us around that they'll start telling us a few more things about what actually goes on in some of the meetings we're barred from.
Well, we have someone on the line who is arguably the former Amy of The Office, although he will not like to be described that way. So I'd like to bring in from Washington, Ron Klain, who knows a thing or two about real Veeps and the people around them. He was chief of staff to two vice presidents, Joe Biden from January 2009 to 2011 and Al Gore from 1995 to 1999. Just to impress you more, he worked on both of Bill Clinton's election campaigns, ran the recount for Gore in 2000, and in fact, Kevin Spacey played him in the HBO movie Recount. So we know who plays him in the movie. Today, Ron is president of Case Holdings. Ron, so glad to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
So you met Ron with the makers of Veep when they were still developing the show, you say. And I know you were still, I think you were still Biden's chief of staff at the time. I'm not sure, but it
was, yes.
Yes. So it now airs and has a chief of staff character who is sort of a disaster. So if you have a beef with Armando about the way they're portraying the chief of staff, this is your moment to be heard.
Well, look, I'm a huge fan of the show and was happy to meet with Armando and show him around our offices. And, you know, they've captured the physical setting of the office perfectly. It's amazing set and portrayal. You know, I root for Amy in every show. I hope she continues to do a better job and slug away at him. Big fan of Anna Chlumsky, who plays her. You know, and I think that the show fundamentally, you know, obviously there's parts of it that are humorous. There are parts of it that are outsized, and the idea that the vice president spends most of the day waiting for the president to call obviously is unrealistic and untrue of how the modern vice presidency works. But I'll say it does do two things with incredible accuracy that are important. I think one, as Armando was just discussing, it portrays some of these staff archetypes just perfectly. They got kind of heroicized in the West Wing. They're humanized on Veep. And everyone who works in Washington knows a Dan, knows a Sue, knows a Jonah, and it's great. And the second thing, I think in terms of the vice presidency, it's an odd office, and it kind of builds on Armando's work at In the Loop. It's an office that has a lot of power and yet no power. And the power of the vice presidency comes from not some specific portfolio, but from how the vice president works with the president, his or her own guile, cleverness, wits. And that's the struggle you see Selena do every week on the show. And I think that part of it's pretty interesting and pretty fun to watch.
You mentioned In the Loop, Ron, so I want to play a clip from the movie. It was a hilarious Oscar-nominated movie. It came out in 2009, and it essentially tells about American and British officials talking them into a war in the Middle East based on dodgy intelligence provided by London. Sound familiar? In this scene, two American officials are sparring over the march to war, and they turn to Britain's Minister for International Development, the hapless Simon Foster. He has a bad habit of coming up with inane phrases when he doesn't know what to say.
Has a decision already been made in principle to advocate invasion?
I would refer you to the recent comments of our colleague from the UK, Mr. Simon Foster, in that regard.
Yes, I think that Mr. Foster would have something to say to that.
I'm certainly hearing both sides. In England, we have a saying for very situations such as this, which is that it's difficult, lemon difficult.
Lemon difficult. Ron.
It's only because just before that meeting, his aide said easy peasy lemon squeezy to him. And so the phrase stuck.
Armando, is it truer of British politics? The open admission of how crazy things can get, and we're in the U.S. less willing to acknowledge that it's just humorous and ridiculous a lot of times?
I don't know. There's always a little bit more cynicism from the British public about British politicians. And also, you have the advantage in America of certain roles being, you know, both being underwritten by the Constitution and also being not just the presidency, but commander-in-chief and head of state. Whereas our politicians are separated from that sense of kind of high profile. We're much more dismissive of our politicians. You know, on the night of an election, if a prime minister loses, he or she literally are packing their bags and driving off the very next day. Whereas, you know, you allow your lost presidents the benefit of 2.5 months before they have to leave office. So I think we're less deferential mm-hmm. about the office. So I think we're much more, it doesn't come as a surprise to us that that's the sort of behavior that goes on behind closed doors in the UK.
Ron, I listened to that clip and he's saying lemon difficult, and it's just cringeworthy because you could imagine this happening in real life as we're watching it in the press side of the White House. We know that you guys on your side of the White House are thinking, how do we get him out of this? How do we get him out of this? Was that one a pretty real moment for you?
Well, sure. I mean, obviously, you know, elected officials are exposed to a lot of exposed to the press a lot. A lot of interviews. Not doesn't always go as well as the staff would like to see it go. And you know, I love watching the staff on Veep try to deal with that. You know, there are times when they're making horrible staffing choices, but that's you know, that's part of the humor of the show and part of the joy of the show. And you know, and I think that cleaning up after you know, helping these politicians sort through the challenges of facing the press is part of what the staff does, and it's really well portrayed on the show.
I want to play for a moment something from another TV drama in the TV show in the U.S. about the White House. This one took a much more serious tone, The West Wing. And it's a scene here from the second season of the series. And it has a very different approach. It's solemnity and seriousness of purpose. You'll hear Martin Sheen's character, President Bartlet, delivering his State of the Union address. And his adoring staff are somewhere else watching him on C-SPAN, hanging on every word. And unlike Selina Meyer's staff, these guys are blown away by their principal.
To widen the circle of opportunity, to deepen the meaning of our freedom, to form a more perfect union. Our best days lie ahead. God bless you. God bless the United States of America.
Ron, The West Wing was hugely popular and hugely earnest about our politics. Do you think it took a Brit to come in and help us laugh about the way Washington really works?
Well, perhaps it did. Perhaps someone from outside had to hold up the mirror and make us look at ourselves with a little more realism to it. Look, I think the truth about life in the West Wing, life in the vice president's office, is somewhere between those two extremes. I had tremendous respect, and the whole staff had tremendous respect for both the vice presidents we worked for, and I know Republicans had tremendous respect for the vice presidents they worked for, and I don't think that the way kind of Selina is a vice president is realistic that way. But I think the West Wing goes too far in the opposite direction. It's all, you know, just completely perfect and everything goes perfectly. And at the end of every hour, there's a happy ending and so on and so forth. And that's not what life was like in the West Wing either. So I think if I say to young people all the time, watch 5 hours of the West Wing, watch 5 hours of Veep, put the two of them together, and you'll have a pretty good sense of what life is really like inside the White House.
Armando, you're a guidebook to working in Washington, half a guidebook.
Half a guidebook, yes. I mean, The West Wing. I was a big fan of The West Wing. I loved the language in The West Wing. I'm also reminded that clip reminded me of course of President Clinton's first State of the Union address, where he famously they put up the wrong draft of mm-hmm. the speech, and so he sort of had to wing it for the first 20 minutes while they found the right draft. And those first 20 minutes were actually the best part of the address.
I'm Jessica Yellen. This is On Point. I'm in for Tom Ashbrook. My guest is Armando Iannucci, writer and director of HBO's Veep, and Ron Klain, former chief of staff to our current Vice President Joe Biden, and before that, Al Gore. Gentlemen, I want to play for both of you a clip from the third season pilot premiere episode of Veep, where Julia Louis-Dreyfus, the character who plays the vice president, attends the funeral of an Iowa congressman just before she's preparing to announce her presidential candidacy. And for listeners to understand, she's running into Blake Stewart, who's played by Kevin O'Rourke. He's a failed presidential nominee from a decade prior. He's so depressive and so conscious of his has-been status that he identifies with the dead congressman whose name is Cowgill.
What was it like, the campaign, for you?
Exciting. Then exhausting. Then I died. Joking. Kinda.
Well, you're out of it now, so that's good.
I used to think that I failed because of my team. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't have the right chief of staff, campaign manager, comms guys, my then wife. But no, it was me. I just didn't have it.
Well, very few of us do.
Right. Like Cowgill.
Poor Cowgill.
I kind of wish it was me in that box.
Armando, are you saying politicians see themselves as good as dead once they're out of the business?
Well, poor Blake Stewart, he did lose 49 states, it has to be said. So it wasn't a cliffhanger like the Gore Bush election. But there is that, I mean, we have a phrase over in the UK, which is all political careers end in tragedy. And there is that sense that no matter how hard you try, there's always an ending, and the ending is seldom pretty. I think you benefit in the US by having these term limits, so you kind of know you can't carry on beyond your ability. Whereas in the UK, we do have politicians who try and hang on a little bit too long. So we have the likes of the Thatchers and the Blairs who stay beyond 10 years, and then it all goes tragically and sadly wrong.
But it makes for good comedy.
Twilight months. It makes for good comedy, but I mean, there is that sense. And also what I was saying earlier about the fact, I think a lot of politicians do go into politics with the noblest of intentions. You know, of course, they might be ambitious and they might be attracted to power, but that's perfectly natural. But I think they do go in because they genuinely want to make a difference. And you know, if they want to earn money, there are other ways to earn money. So it's not about that, really. I think there's a definite point of principle that they have there, really. And I don't think we should lose sight of that fact. It's just what do they have to do in order to just survive in that environment is really, you know, the question that the program is trying to ask of us, really.
Ron, the comedy here is that though people go in with the noblest of intentions, once in office or once working for someone important, it often devolves, I won't say always, but often devolves into a lot of infighting. That seems to me a pretty fair description.
Well, you know, in 1999, I was Vice President Gore's chief of staff as he was getting his presidential campaign underway, and we had a lot of invite in the office, and I got fired. And then the people who fired me got fired, and I came back 8 months later and helped on the campaign. So, you know, I watch what Amy's going through right now with a pit in my stomach and a lot of anxiety about her future. But look, I do think, I appreciate what Armando said a minute ago. I think both Democrats and Republicans, it's not a partisan comment, I think, come to public service with a great deal of idealism, and most often for all the right reasons. And they're in a system that is loaded with absurdity and stress and pressure and ridiculous situations. And when those two things collide, you often do get humor. And I think that's the essence of what you see on Veep every week, and I love watching it.
You're up, you're down,
also,
you're... Go ahead.
Sorry, I just wanted to say, I think there's also something else has happened since, say, The West Wing was on. The West Wing was a very aspirational show, and I think was at a time when I think the public still had, you know, a certain amount of respect for the political process. I think nowadays something like The West Wing wouldn't survive because the public is much more frustrated with Washington. I'm thinking more about the politics of Congress, really. The fact that the two parties have moved away from bipartisanship and have become much more divided, and the fact that there's a gridlock up in the Hill, and therefore quite a lot of politics today is all about what we won't do, you know, what we'll veto or what we'll stop, what we'll filibuster, what we'll vote against, who will vote out. And I think the public are beginning to feel detached from the political process. So there's a certain amount of anger and frustration, I think, that means maybe the slightly more jaded representation of politics in Veep is the one that seems to fit more naturally today.
There's another element to the show, which is that she is a female politician, a female in very high office, close to the presidency. And you're very careful about the way you bring that out, because she tries often to downplay her womanness as much as she tries to flirt with her husband or individual people. In public, the vice president, Selina Mayer, is very conscious of just being a politician, not a woman politician. Armando, is that something you've identified in American culture? Or is that true there?
Well, it was really, when we wrote it, we thought, let's not have people think, is this a parody of Joe Biden? Is this a parody of Al Gore or Dick Cheney? Okay, let's make her a woman. So we're not looking back, we're looking forward. Then, of course, people thought, oh, well, is it Sarah Palin or is it Hillary Clinton? And it's neither. It's who she is. And Julia inhabits the role and makes it her own. I, for one, didn't want the show to be about being a woman in politics. However, you know, as any woman politician will tell you, it's very different when you're a woman. You know, what you wear and how you look suddenly gets addressed and gets commented on. You know, if you wear dowdy clothes, you're seen as dowdy. But if you try and brighten up, you're seen as being extravagant. There's a lot of frustrations, I think, female politicians feel about the different sort of treatment they get. And also that feeling that they have to almost act more macho than male politicians to show that they can, you know, they can be commander in chief and they can sit down with the military and they can order cuts here and, you know, they can make hard decisions there. So I think there's an added pressure. If the pressure wasn't bad enough, there's an added pressure when you're a female politician.
Ron, there's a popular Washington parlor game, who would play you in the movie? And you already know the answer. It was Kevin Spacey played you in the HBO movie Recount. So I wonder if now HBO has, or I should say now Kevin Spacey has another role, House of Cards. Are you more the Recount guy? Or are you the House of Cards kind of guy?
Well, I love watching House of Cards. You know, it does always strike me that Kevin Spacey generally plays villainous characters, from Lex Luthor to winning an Academy Award for playing a middle-class suburban dad who slept with his daughter's best friend, to Jack Abramoff. So it's and Richard III, most famously on the stage. So, you know, I think I hope I'm the one non-villainous character he's played recently, and I was pleased to see he now signed a deal to play Winston Churchill in an upcoming film. So hopefully that raises the bar a little bit.
You're in good company.
It improves my company considerably.
So I wonder if either of you, let me put this to you, Armando. If you've said in Yes Minister, for example, a British sitcom about a government official and his aide, that people told you that they found it enlightening, that it was actually for them a window into how politics really works. Is that part of your intention here, to let people see the ugly side of things?
Well, or is to see what it's really like. The thing about Yes Minister was, at the time that show came out, and it was a very traditionally shot sitcom in front of an audience, with cardboard sets that sometimes wobbled when people slammed the doors. We didn't have cameras in the House of Commons then. We only had just started having radio broadcasts from there. So something as fictional as Yes Minister was actually in many ways the first documentary viewing we had about how politics worked in the UK. I think it's a little bit more, always has been a little bit more sophisticated in the US with cameras in courts as well as both houses and press conferences and so on. I think for me, you know, the show above all is meant to be a comedy. It's meant to be an entertainment. But for me, I find it funnier the more real it feels. And therefore, we put a lot of work into trying to get the details right. You know, I would hate it if we'd made a show where people in DC were saying it's nothing like that at all. But I don't expect people to have a degree in politics to get it, because it's fundamentally about, you know, it's about human beings. It's about how we all behave when we're put in these pressure cooker kind of environments and are forced to come up with decisions time and time again with a lot of pressure on us and no opportunity to make mistakes. It's really, I'm trying to make it universal by making it very particular at the same time.
Armando, as much as you get the particulars pretty dead on right, I'm constantly reading DC writers posting fact checks of the show saying, oh, she shouldn't be working across the street in the building next to the West Wing. She should be working in the West Wing where the vice president really is. And as you mentioned, why does she have such a tiny staff when in reality it takes a village? When you read those things, do you get irritated? You want to tell them, hey, guys, it's just a TV show.
No, I don't mind that, because occasionally, you know, they'll throw the odd bit up that I think, oh, yes, we must correct that. I think we were about to do something completely different. But, as I say, it's a comedy. It's a heightened version of reality. I hope it feels real, but it's a heightened version. And of necessity, we have to simplify it. You know, so we have the 5 or 6 key staff rather than the 500 or 600 key staff. And, you know, in answer to the West Wing office thing, I mean, she did use her West Wing office a lot more in the second season when she was allowed to
get
a little bit more closer to the president. But it's what Ron was saying earlier. The job of vice president really is defined by the president. The constitutional responsibilities are basically being there to stand in for the president if the president's incapacitated, and being president of the Senate. That's it. Anything else is at the whim of the president. And that's where the comedy comes from. Someone with a lot of talent and ability suddenly being subservient to the whims of someone else.
Ron, I have a question and a beef, because on all these shows, we see on Scandal, which is also about the White House in Washington, and on Veep, every so often you see people going into the Oval Office and sitting and having a conversation there without the president present. And I've never seen that. You've worked there for many years. Do people have conversations in the Oval without the president?
Almost never. I mean, it is his office, and it's not a staff sitting room or a meeting area. In the West Wing, that's the Roosevelt Room that the staff uses for meetings without the president. But look, I do think, I mean, I'm very sympathetic to what Armando has done here in the sense that is every little detail right? No. Is the portrayal heightened and exaggerated? Of course. Are the characters on Veep a lot better looking and a lot more funny than their real-life counterparts? You know, absolutely, in both accounts.
More profane?
And I'm not sure about more profane. I think he may be pretty spot on there. But what I do think the show gives you is really the essence of what life is like inside the White House. The combination of both the extreme importance and extreme absurdity of a lot of these situations, the tension, the pressure, the conflicts, the staff conflicts that come out as a result of that, the jockeying for power and roles and responsibilities. I think all those things are really, really well captured. And the sets, as I said earlier, the sets are just spectacularly done. The detail, for example, on the historic wallpaper in the old executive office building,
which you've
never seen on television before. Yeah, I mean, because it's really the old executive office building. For those of you who haven't been there, it's a spectacular old building. With hand-painted wallpaper in many rooms, it traces back the time when Teddy Roosevelt worked as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, worked in the offices that are now the Vice President's offices in the OEOB, and just like a lot of the attention to detail that they've done on the show Veep around that is really spectacular. And
the thing I noticed when I went round it, when you showed me around it, was when you looked up, it was beautiful, it was magnificent. There was all this the tracing on the walls and the marvelous chandeliers. Then when you looked down on the ground, it was a mess. There were lots of temporary partitions and people's little knickknacks and gonks kind of laid on their desks and so on. And I loved that kind of contrast that you wouldn't have expected when you look at the exterior of the building.
Let's play another clip from the show. This is Julia Louis-Dreyfus again in the third season premiere. She's laying the groundwork for her eventual shot at the White House by eulogizing an unpopular Iowa congressman, Rick Cowgill, whom she barely knows. And she describes his life based on what a local aide told her moments before she started to speak about his likes and dislikes.
Rick's life reflects America. He was an avid fisherman. And as a congressman, gosh, did he know how to cast upstream, to anticipate it. And when he got that first bite, whoa, did he reel it in. He was a nuanced politician with a mighty big collection of beer labels.
So she's making all this up sort of on the fly. Armando, does it surprise you, given all this, that some politicians have said they want to appear on your show?
Yes, goodness knows why.
And you always
what
say
are
no?
They expecting? We always say no. Simply because we've said it in this parallel world where we don't hear the name of the party that she's a member of, and we don't see or hear the name of the president. And I think it would spoil it if we saw it's a politics free zone in certain respects. If a real politician turned up, it would beg so many questions like, oh, so therefore is that the Obama presidency we're in, or what is it? So they're more than welcome to come and watch and be taken on a tour of our set.
finally, in our last moments, do you wish us to learn anything about politics or change anything from the show, through the show?
Well, only in, you know, as I say, it's primarily in entertainment, and I just want people to be able to find it funny and laugh. But if it makes us think about what it is we're doing to our politicians, but also if it's making us become aware that there are certain flaws, there's a certain gridlock in politics that somehow we have to do something about, then that's great. You know, I hope it doesn't put people off going into politics.
Armando Iannucci, writer and director of HBO's Veep, thanks so much for being with us. And Ron Klain, former chief of staff to 2 vice presidents. Both of you, pleasure to talk to you. You can join the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Coming up on Monday on Point, everyone hates hypocrisy, but hold on, says one philosopher, we're all hypocrites. I'm Jessica Yellen for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.